Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries. And I'd like to welcome you to the fall season, the fall 2006 season of the Michigan Writers Series. I'm very happy to welcome as our guest Lev Raphael. But before I introduce Lev, I just want to say a few words about the Michigan Writers Series. The reading by our guest author will last about 30 to 40 minutes. Afterwards, there will be time for questions and answers. The reading and the questions and answers are recorded. The MSU libraries through the Digital Media Center digitizes the recording and puts it on the World Wide Web where you can listen to it again, or folks anywhere in the world could have the opportunity to listen to Lev, as they can the other 70 authors who have appeared as part of the Michigan Writers Series. One final note, books by Lev Raphael are for sale outside the door, and so if you want to pick up some afterwards, and I'm sure Lev would be happy to sign them as well for you. Lev Raphael is one of America's foremost second-generation writers. Born and raised in New York City, he earned an MFA in creative writing at University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he won the Harvey Swattis Fiction Prize. His story collection, Dancing on Tisha B'Av, won a 1990 Lambda Literary Award, and he is also the author of two novels about survivor families, Winter Eyes and The German Money, a collection of essays and memoirs, Journey and Arrival, a book about Edith Wharton's life and fiction, and several co-authored books in psychology and education. His most recent titles are Secret Anniversaries of the Heart and Writing a Jewish Life. Raphael has published dozens of stories, essays, and articles in a wide range of publications. His fiction has been anthologized in over two dozen collections in the United States and Britain, most recently in Who We Are, On Being and Not Being, an American Jewish writer, which includes works by many luminaries. He's the author of the Nick Hoffman Mystery Series set in Michigan at the fictional State University of Michigan in Michiganopolis, and is the winner of the Reed Smith Fiction Prize and International Quarterly's Prize for Innovative Writing. Lev Raphael has done hundreds of talks and readings in North America, Europe, and Israel at book fairs, colleges, and universities, synagogues, and bookstores, and conferences. His stories and essays are on university syllabi around the United States and in Canada. Lev Raphael holds a PhD in American Studies from Michigan State University, where he taught creative writing. His work has been translated into nearly a dozen languages. And one final note, Lev Raphael holds a special place in the hearts of all of us associated with the Michigan Writers Series, because in January of 1999, on a cold, foggy night, Lev appeared here along with Lauren Estelman as our first guest in the Michigan Writers Series, and the rest is history, as they say. So please join me in welcoming Lev Raphael.
Thank you for coming on a Friday night, and I have to add that Peter forgot to mention I will not only sign my books, I will sign books by other people. I have no shame. I will simply write, this isn't mine, but it's really quite good. I had totally forgotten that I was at the beginning of this series, so it's nice to be here. Midway, perhaps? I hope it's not the end. This isn't my last chance. It's always great to read at in Michigan and at Michigan State, and I think one of my best experiences at Michigan State was appearing twice in classes that taught one of my mysteries, which is set at a school that might resemble MSU in some small way. What's very gratifying to a writer is to be recognized at home, because it's very easy to, or easier to be recognized away from home, but when we are honored and recognized at home, it means a lot. This is the first time in my career of 25 years that I've had two books out at almost exactly the same time, my memoirs, Writing a Jewish Life, and my book of short stories, Secret Anniversaries of the Heart. I don't think my publishers planned it, and in fact, I think each was annoyed that the other published a book at the same time. For me, it was pretty exciting and unexpected. I'm going to read something short from each book and to give you a feel for what the books are like and what they offer. Peter refer to me as being one of America's second generation writers. And for those of you who don't know, second generation is the phrase that's used to describe children of Holocaust survivors. And of course, with the American fondness for abbreviations, we're now called 2G, which always makes me think of 2G or not 2G. But when I announced that at a reading in Canada, the Canadians were all outraged. They said, why do you always have to make everything sound so cute, even the Holocaust? I don't understand it. But there's 2G, and our children, the next generation, is now called 3G. So this story is the first story in the collection. The themes of the collection are sexuality, homophobia, the Holocaust, living with it as a survivor, living with its impact as a child of survivors. And this is my favorite story from the collection, and one that I will be reading everywhere I go in Germany when I go back for a tour sponsored by my German publisher next spring. So when you listen to this, imagine a German audience. It should be quite interesting for them too. This is called the Tante, which is Yiddish for aunt, and German for aunt. Those rare times that the Tante talked about the war, we all shifted nervously at the table, unable to change the subject or know just how to respond. We were captured like a circle of unwilling believers in the occult whose medium has sunk into a trance. What she said then would be like a violent telegram. Once I stood in mud and rain, 2 days naked. Or the day we were liberated, the Elbe, it was flowing with bodies. When she stopped, we went on eating, passing dishes, cutting, spooning, the surge of mealtime sweeping us away from her private wasteland. Ours was a large formal dining room in a dark, rent-controlled Upper West Side apartment with sliding doors stale from 75 years of paint, glass-doored china cupboards set into the wall, plaster stars and arabesques bubbling the high ceiling. The Tante made that room more natural and fitting than any of us could because she was a woman of bearing. Straight-backed and hard like an old upright piano, she was gray-haired, gray-eyed, and handsome as much for being 70 and firm as for anything else. We called my mother's great aunt Rose the Tanta, as if she, the only close European relative of ours who had survived, not just the Nazis, but Russians, Ukrainians, as if she would always live and speak in capital letters. She had come to stay with us 5 years after her husband, a rich dentist, had died. I was 12, and my sister Melanie had moved to California to join an architectural design firm. The Tante filled Melanie's large empty room with books in 6 or 7 languages, the strange gold-stamped spines leering at me from ceiling-high shelves like eager gypsies. Many books were by writers behind the Iron Curtain, cries of outrage, cries for help, she said, or cunning little parables that mocked and burned. I envied her, but it was more than just the books. It was everything I dimly understood her to represent. Europe, sophistication, travel, a larger, more glamorous world. For other Jews, I suppose their old country relatives summon up a personalized Fiddler on the Roof, a glowing cartoon. But the Tante was so resolutely un-Jewish, and her parents before her, that I just couldn't imagine her haggling in a marketplace, whistling a mournful Yiddish tune, attending a Zionist meeting, doing anything ordinary and Jewish that mass death had made seem otherworldly. Rather, I saw her as one of those lustrous women in 30s movies, forcefully in love, her stabbing words like brisk steps taken in a walk to mend her health, stalking her sleek young man, Francis Lederer, perhaps, with a large leather bag clutched under one arm and a cigarette waiting to be lit. The Tante smoked with spiteful grace, one arm close in and parallel to her waist, palm up, supporting the elbow of the arm that leaned out slowly, slightly from her body as smoke twined up from her sobrani gold. I thought that I loved her. My father, an accountant, found her affected. Nobody in his family spoke with an English accent or read more than Time or Newsweek magazine. He glanced at her book suspiciously and never commented when she talked about school. After moving in with us, Atanta had decided to take classes in French literature and French criticism at Columbia University, and the comments on her papers amazed me. I had never myself leapt from all those cute little French tales of kids getting into trouble and making stupid puns to the world of great books. So the Tante's familiarity with writers I found impossible, even in English, awed me. She seemed to glide through that alien world like a dangerous debutante cutting across a dance floor with all the decision of great and untried beauty. When Natasha mentioned a paper or one of her classes, my mother would look away, perhaps paying the Tante back for her criticism of the Jewish things we did, like lighting candles on Friday night, keeping kosher at home, and observing a number of the holidays. Once, soon after she moved in, the Tante had peered at Mother as she covered her eyes and blessed the candles in their tall brass stands. "What are you looking at?" she asked the Tante. "Finished?" The Tante shrugged with all the distance of an anthropologist, unwilling to influence the primitive tribe he was studying. Mother slid the lace covering from her head and said with great dignity, "I light candles because I am a Jew. So was my mother, so was your mother." The Tante nodded and shrugged, wickedly slim in gray silk and pearls. "I believe in God," Mother said, heading for the kitchen. "They prayed," the Tante called after her. "Oh yes, they prayed, and still they died." Well, I knew who they meant. All the lost Jews who spoke to us in pictures, films, and books, so terribly nameless in their millions. "Yes," my mother retorted, "but some of them believed," and she bore the steaming blue tureen to the table. The Tante waved it away. "Whatever you say." Dad came in from the bathroom, smoothing back his hair, scrubbed face as shiny as the challah, waiting for his knife. The Tante avoided our Passover seders and candlelighting at Hanukkah, happily sweeping off to a concert, party, or film that would spare her the affront. The rustle of her cape and her lush scent, white shoulders, I believe, would mockingly crowd the air, and we would all want her to be there with us. Dad, because he said she was our responsibility. Mother, because she was family. And me, because somehow, with the cosmic vanity of adolescence, I hoped the Tante would convert. I hoped our vague but steady faith would warm her, would heal the past I knew so little of. But she appeared content in her world of books, chatting about editions, critics, translations, conferences. I would hear her on the phone sometimes, flashes of English bursting from sentences in other languages. We rarely met her friends. She entertained them in restaurants, as one did in Europe, and she often seemed less to be living with us than visiting until a more suitable arrangement presented itself. Did she miss her large home on Long Island or the furniture she had donated to Jewish charities? I didn't know. The Tante was as private about the recent past as she was about the war. When she had trouble with a paper, she would call me to her curtained room and hold out a page wrenched from her old typewriter. "Is it good?" she'd ask, which meant, was it English? It was, usually, but always with a trace of another language, like the remains of a figure incompletely painted out on a canvas. She knew Russian, German, French, Hungarian, Czech, Slovak, Polish, so who could say what was stirring in her mind as she resolutely typed and typed and typed. If I told her that it was good, she would lean back slim and stern and explain the paper in a lecture that could last half an hour. Her talk was bright and blinding, and if I did comment, she would nod regally. My parents were glad that I talked to her. She was so foreign and disapproving. At dinner, the table could often seem impoverished by her air of acquaintance with finer meals, more elegant company. Though not for me, of course. It was precisely her detachment I adored. She was the perfect figure of romance for a teenager, someone I saw a great deal of, but knew mostly through my imagination. My visions could not be blurred by facts: her occasional ugly limp due to arthritis, her rumbling stomach, her spotty, wrinkled hands from which she'd long since removed all jewelry to make them less noticeable, her gray hairs in the bathroom sink. When she contradicted mother or dad about, say, politics, they would defer to her history while I enjoyed the pageantry of grimaces and frowns, because she was the Tanta. We were more ourselves, too. The Americans, possibly, or the ungrateful. It's hard to say. The Tanta was so much a presence in a large, shabby apartment with its leprous windows and gouged parquet floors that maybe we were just an audience. Maybe we were even less, just a background. It was the Tanta and her talking to me in a pungent voice smothered by years of smoking who brought me out of the blindness of my youth. She was the first person I observed wholeheartedly and with greed. "You're so American," she sometimes said, and the word always came from her with surprise, as if she wondered, how could such a creature be related to her? That thrilling reproach filled my mind with fireworks of speculation, great bursting cascades. She was not American, and the difference was no mere attribute of geography or time. It was more. It was mysterious. The older I got, the more I found myself watching her, studying her, the hand extended to the hollow of her neck, fingers gentle there, the matchbook she often twirled and tormented over and over when bored. In senior year of high school, when an English teacher asked us to do a character sketch of the most unusual person we knew, well, I chose the Tanta. Now, my teachers had always said that my writing had flair, but I realized at last I had something more. A treasure. The Tanta was mine. Someone to write about, rich with possibility, and I was important. I imagined writing a book someday that would gleam down from her shelves. I brought together the years of reports, skits, and sketches and put all my writing in a box under my bed. I had a history. So I wrote a little story about her, about having dinner with her, her classes, her books, her ankle-length mink coat, everything, her contempt for my parents. But what I concentrated on was when she would blurt out parts of the past, how I felt helpless then, trapped, assaulted by each unbearable word that I could not really understand. Writing, I realized how the Tanta crushed us with what had happened to her and how I hated it, hated her even, just a bit. My teacher said the story had energy and pushed me to submit it to our yearbook. His praise was so nagging that I finally took it to the small yearbook office, seething with posters, photos, clippings, and files, and gave it to a thin, bleary-eyed girl who accepted it from me impatiently, as if I were late. I was excited and triumphant, without knowing if it would be printed, as if those few pages were brighter and more alive than the Tanta herself could ever be. The story was my child. It seemed perfect. 3 months later, bound in a heavy red and black cover, crammed with class pictures and poetry, the yearbook frightened me. Mine was the only piece of fiction, relevant, I guess, because the class was 90% Jewish, and it said way too much. It revealed too much about me and how I felt. I had mistaken simple observation for creation, the amateur writer's ugliest confusion. There was no distance. No shaping, no disguise, and it was too raw. I was ashamed. "So, where's the yearbook already?" Dad asked me the week it came out. My mother smiled expectantly, and I muttered something about a printer's delay. I imagined falling at the Tanta's slim, small feet, her walls of books a judgment of my crime, begging her to understand, to feel for me forgiveness, mercy, love. I saw the Tanta accepting me for the sake of literature. We would cry. We would be close. She would become my muse, my guide. It was not like that at all. Before I could figure out how to prepare everyone, a friend's mother brought a copy of the yearbook over, beaming and a bit jealous. "My Marcy also gave in a story, but she wasn't so lucky as you." La Tanta waited for me one Thursday afternoon in my room. The desk chair turned to the open door, smoke wreathing the curtain rod, her eyes cold. We were alone. "How could you?" she said. "It was just an assignment. Why do you want to hurt me?" "No," I said, "I love you." But I didn't know if I believed that. She rose with a quivering face, and I expected her to advance on me with her cigarette and burn my desperate tongue. "That's love?" I fled the room, grabbing my jacket from the bench in the foyer. I missed dinner that night, staying out to see a James Bond movie twice, hiding in the shadows and the light of the balcony and gold ceiling Depression-era theater. When fatigue brought me home, there was more. The Tanta had gone to stay with a friend for the night. "How could you write this?" my father asked, holding up the yearbook as if it were the photograph of a desecrated synagogue. We sat at the dining room table like survivors of some dreadful break in ordinary time, the cool mahogany reflecting our hands. "What is wrong with you?" he asked. I shook my head. If he'd accused me or threatened me, I could have yelled something about art, I guess. But he was only disappointed and hurt. My mother, sitting in the Tanta's place, clasped her hands. "I've never seen her like that." The Tanta's cold rage was alien. None of us had ever seen her like that. Seen beneath the languages, the pearls, except when she suddenly spoke about the war in those terrible few lines. I wasn't close to my sister Melanie, who was 15 years older, but I called her that night, hoping she would take my side. What was my side, though? I pictured Melanie sitting out in her lush English-style garden, complete with gazebo, oak benches, and elegant, expensive shrubs. She was curt. "Don't do it again, kiddo, and you better apologize fast." "The Tanta can't sleep," my mother told me. "She keeps dreaming about you, that she's trying to climb out of a pit hanging on the edge, and that you're a Nazi stomping on her hands." My mother was pale and wide-eyed, as if the dream were true. She shook her head. "Why couldn't you leave her alone?" A week later, the Tanta decided not to finish her semester at Columbia and to go visit friends in Brussels. She was quickly packed and gone. The days before her flight were bitter. She stopped eating with us entirely and wouldn't talk about what had happened, about not sleeping anymore, but she played the radio in her room softly through the night, reading. I feared more disaster, like a child, some nighttime curse that would tumble down my walls or smother me in books, her books. But the Tanta said and did nothing. Hers was the cruelty of silence. She wrote to my parents from Brussels, then Paris, Marseille, Madrid, Rome, Venice, Vienna. The postcards, even the stamps, dazzled me. She was triumphantly the woman of Europe again, distant and immense, but colored now by my shame. I shot off several wild letters of apology she might have received and even read, but I never found out. The Tanta died in Prague on the eve of Yom Kippur and was buried there by a distant cousin of her husband. Hushed, surprised, my mother said, "It's a saint's death to die then," repeating a Jewish superstition I had never heard before. Did the Tanta go to get away from me? That's what I believed at first. I imagined her feeling humiliated by my words, powerless, exposed, forced to plunge into the volcano of her past, which we knew only in its rumbles and flashes of steam and fire. I must have seemed perverse to her, a snake of disapproval and contempt, spying on her soul, or thinking I had. "Another month," she told us flatly once at dinner. "Another month, the Allies would have found nothing. No one, nobody. Cholera," she explained. "Dysentery." If her camp had been liberated in May of 1945 and not April, she would not have lived. So spring was much more to her than weather or a song. Did she go to find her past? Why was she in Prague? To see if her home still stood and who lived there? In synagogue on Yom Kippur with my parents, I cried for the first time ever, not even knowing that she was dead. beating my heart as I recited the collective prayer of guilt, the Amshamnu. We abuse, we betray, we are cruel, we destroy, we embitter, we falsify. I had to atone for writing about her, but she would not let me, and begging God's forgiveness did not seem like enough. My father squeezed my arm through the prayer shawl, whose fringes I knew were supposed to remind me not to follow the desires of my heart. What had I done? A postcard from Prague came to me 2 weeks later, well after we heard that Tanta was dead. I don't know why or how it was delayed. You had no right to steal from me, it said. My life is not an assignment. And I remembered overhearing her on the phone one time, years before. Oh my, these Americans, they're like vampires, she said. Then she switched to French. Dégoûtant, disgusting. She went on in English. They feed on everyone's disasters because it makes them feel happy and safe. Pauvre petit, poor little things. And I heard all the times that she had marveled at me. You are so American. I've been interrupted by cash registers at bookstores, thunderstorms, people wandering by in bookstores, looking at me, eyeing me up and down, and deciding they didn't want to stay. But that's the first that sort of public service announcement. That's what we all need, right, every now and then. Well, Writing a Jewish Life is a series of memoirs about being a child of survivors, about trips to my trips to Israel, about the gay rights scene there, about there's even something about one of my dogs. It sort of binds together three different strands of my life and my career as a writer, being a child of Holocaust survivors, finding Jewish identity, finding gay identity, and this is a piece that deals with some of these issues, and it's also something that many of us will have to deal with it one if we haven't dealt with it already. I wrote it before my mother died, and it's called Losing My Mother, and this was my way of mourning. Today, my mother is in ruins, the blurred outline of a person, rigid, eyes vacant, leaning sideways in a wheelchair, almost bald, eyes rheumy. She has to be fed. It takes my father 2 whole hours to get the food inside her unavailing mouth. My brother holds her nose to force her mouth open. His way, she's fed in half an hour, 40 minutes tops, but my father can't do it like that. Face collapsed, she recognizes no one, and she's silent. It is a vast and horrible silence that she fell into after strange leave takings. When the small strokes became more severe and crippling, when she had to be put at 73 on drugs to keep her from violence, she started speaking with a foreign gentleness, like a kindly scientist explaining very complicated processes to children barely able to comprehend. Her voice was so soft you had to lean in. What was she saying? My father, shaking his head, but listening, said, nothing. Nonsense. And when I listened, I heard amid the Russian of her childhood what sounded like rhymes, wordplay of some kind. She's not saying anything, my father insisted. But I thought she was saying goodbye. Retreating first from English and even her everyday Yiddish with my father way back into her first language, what she spoke in St. Petersburg until 1919, and in Poland afterwards, retreating into Russian baby talk. The baby talk was almost the end. After that, the sentences dried up, halted, seeming to collide with an invisible barrier. Perhaps they were simply tired. The burden of carrying so much of a life, its beginning and its end, too much, too crippling. Finally, there was silence, at first broken by an intermittent yes or no when my father asked if she recognized him or recognized anyone. He was trying to lure her back into life through speech, But the last full sentence I ever heard from her was, "Oh, Alex, stop pestering me," in English, after he asked her four times if she knew who I was. He would not admit that she was vanishing. He regarded the slightest change, the slightest flicker of attention as proof that she was getting better. Even now, when she's been institutionalized for more than a year, he can insist, "She knows everything I say. She understands." And he's excited and convinced that on some days she really is better. But then he had denied her illness, covered it for at least a year before she was institutionalized. I suspected something. Whenever I called home, she sounded tired and distracted. He almost always answered the phone. Hoping in my own blind way for a change in our relationship, I thought he might be wanting more closeness between us. I thought he actually wanted to speak to me. He knew something was wrong, so he kept her from the phone. And I was a little relieved not to talk to her. She had been an unstoppable talker all my life, sometimes unbearable. Once I had a friend over and I was in agony to get my mother to shut up, to leave us alone, to stop being so engaging, so loquacious. I couldn't believe she was so out of touch with the moment, painfully gauche. Her charm was too desperate. She had a heavy laugh that strained her throat, an attempt at lightness that wasn't easy for her, and not just because of the chain smoking and her dark, persistent cynicism. She was witty, probing, inexhaustible, talking as if to fend off silence, questions, doubts, examination. Politics, endlessly. And she devoured the New York Times and played it back to you, even if you had read the identical articles. She talked about literature, too, especially in her 60s when she went back to college, studying Jacques Derrida, Lacan, the most incomprehensible of writers. How could you even call their work writing? It was mud thrown at a screen. Yet she dug through the mud, delighted, talking, practically a straight-A student. For Mother's Day, during the year she went to school, I could send her, in addition to flowers, a volume, say, of post-structuralist film criticism, and she would love it. Perhaps it was the same impulse that made her do crossword puzzles and read mysteries, a drive to finish something, to make order and sense. My brother says one day, "Don't come in and see her, it's too depressing." I say, "I'll fly to New York if she's dying," but to me, she's already dead, and even in my dreams, she has nothing left to say. The deconstructionist my mother reveled in sometimes print words sous rature, under erasure, with lines running right through them to highlight the inadequacy of those words. The word is there, but the word is struck out, living and dead at the same time. This year in Israel, my uncle tells me the barest details of a story about her years in concentration camps that I had never heard before. Once, in a Latvian camp, she felt someone was punished for something she inadvertently said, and she tried to kill herself. Her life was saved by a German doctor. The Holocaust swallowed her family, her home, her youth. Silence now has swallowed her past. Another day, my brother says, "Well, maybe if you come in, she'd recognize you." But there's no magic to bring her back to life, to bring her back to words, because my mother is under erasure. My mother had survived. She had a striped concentration camp dress. She had a wooden ring with a number on it, but I don't know where she had worn either. She never told me. When I was young, when I was not so young, when I was a teenager and even in college, we sat in the L-shaped kitchen, a grim, ordinary Washington Heights Depression-era kitchen with a view of a gray side street across a gated air shaft. We sat and drank coffee and talked about school and life and books and whatever, but there was always another presence at the table in that quiet room, the haunted, haunting past, the past that emerged in stories or bits of stories, flashes. These stories slipped into my life like an unseen cat that suddenly springs to slash your hand. They didn't happen to me, but they're mine now, or at least what I can remember of them, and so they live inside of me, making me, sometimes, afraid of crowds. The panic I felt in a football stadium after a game as hordes surge down the ramps and I am swept along, powerless to pull myself away or out, powerless to stop, feeling I want to scream so they'll let me go. Flashes. In the ghetto, she said, we ground up glass and wrapped it with a little food to put in the rat holes. Then we stuffed the holes with whatever we could find. I think I was supposed to admire her cleverness, the resourceful Jews trapped by the Nazis taking care of themselves. But all I could think of was rats coming through the walls, my walls. A Polish woman said to me, you can always tell a Jew. They have such sad eyes. When they liquidated the ghetto, Polish women spit on us as we were marched out. But here I have to stop. How old was I when those words became not just part of my vocabulary, but part of my life? Liquidated. Ghetto. This is not the imagination of disaster. This is disaster. And I will never not know those words or foggy images. I will never escape. They shaved our heads. Here she breaks off, and the words float in my memory like a ragged cloud with only empty sky around it. She rarely said even those four words together, but years later, I think they hide behind a different pain. When my mother starts losing her hair, the hair that was once luxuriant and alive, before the war and even after for some years, she suffers new defeats. In all of New York City, she cannot find a single wig that looks attractive. But then what wig can hide the losses that no one else sees? She tries vitamins and wisps of hair grow back, but she can't hide her higher brow. I suggest a different man to cut and style and dye her hair, but she erupts in tears, pleading to be let alone. There is no hair there. It's hopeless, is what she means. But I press and press, wanting her to hope, just a little, just about her hair, her looks, something, anything. She was so beautiful once, and now she's given up. Or so it seems to me, a little boy who hasn't lived in hell. I came to dread the ringing of the phone because of times like this, times before I knew how sick my mother was. Casually, my brother Sam tells me, Mom isn't going out as much. She has gas. This is not a conversation I want to have. Yet I cannot help asking, what's wrong with her? It's her ulcer medication, I think. Well, can't they give her something for the gas? But even I know that she probably hasn't mentioned it to her doctor. Embarrassment. So what about the shopping? Well, Dad does it. I don't know what to say. I'm appalled to talk about it. Partly gas. It's the word itself. Farting is a different word, a different world. It's funny. It's Chaucer. And for me, a writer, it's distance. The age of farts, a literary epoch in which farting is a part of life, something you can write about with joy. But gas is something else. Gas is death. It's been a dirty word for me as long as I can remember because gas killed my mother's mother and countless other Jews. Desperate to quell the moles creating their condos in my gorgeous backyard, I hesitantly buy gas shaped like sticks of dynamite. The poison pellets have not worked, and the thought of steel and crushing traps disgusts me, so gas is the only thing left. I'm in the gardening aisle of a local supermarket. Boxes and bottles promising death to small animals face bottles and boxes trumpeting growth and blooms. I lurk like someone in an adult bookstore afraid of being recognized. I make my shoddy purchase and tell nobody how ashamed I am to gas even unseen life, but I feel like a murderer anyway. And then I'm slightly relieved because the gas has no effect whatsoever except to drive me from the yard. My mother's gas, no end to cruelty, the ghetto, the starvation, the camps, and now my mother once again is trapped by gas. Like Mrs. Mendelssohn, my piano teacher for 8 years, Rose Mendelssohn, a Russian Jewish immigrant, frail, slim, dithering. In her 70s, one day at our lesson, she has gas, shocked, 16 or so. I just sit there, she plays some frantic chords to drown the crescendo of stuttering from inside herself, as if it weren't there, banging out those chords, crescendo. She says nothing, I say nothing. But soon I understand that this is why her lessons have dried up. It isn't long before Mrs. Mendelssohn stops her lessons or they stop her, and I have no more interest in the piano anyway. It isn't long before she's locked inside her apartment and the superintendent's wife stands outside the black, steel-clad door calling, Rosie, Rosie, come out, like a children's game. Finally, the woman phones one of Mrs. Mendelssohn's daughters, and they take her away. All this happens off stage. I hear it from my mother, who who sneers at Mrs. Mendelssohn's rich children, children off in some suburb who rarely descend from their heights to our deteriorating Washington Heights neighborhood, children who have abandoned their mother, so my mother says, abandoned her to a stale apartment where she doesn't wash or clean or eat, but just drifts, a gentle specter. I don't want to end up like that, my mother says, over and over. This is her greatest fear, greater than expecting cancer, which she does whenever anything is wrong. My mother's aunt also wound up like that, sliding into oblivion, knowing nothing in her 80s but regrets and accusations. I remember reading of the camps of gas, of Nazi gas, and more, the Jews, their guts betrayed by lack of food, everything stripped away, including dignity, especially dignity. On some slave labor crew digging and hauling rocks, my mother says a man called out, "Hey, you," to a German Jew who reared up at him. "I am not Hey, you. I am Herr Dr. Professor Schmidt, not Hey, you." The reply was quick. "Here, you're just a stinking Jew like all the rest of us." And yes, they do stink. No wonder my mother was always fastidious, talked and nagged at home about hygiene. How has she come to this? Once elegant, battered now by time, bursting inside, drawing inward from the world. It mortifies me to think of her helplessness. And most horribly, I recall the last time I was home, how she didn't know I was awake, I think, and there was a thunderclap from her bedroom. I tell none of this to my brother. Tiny white spots on the brain, my father repeats. I've asked him what the doctor said, what the MRI showed, what it all means, what the name is, hoping to find power in a word or words, but he just cannot remember. So I ask again. Exasperated, my father says, "What do I know what it's called? It's tiny white spots on the brain. I saw the picture." "But that's not the name of an illness. That's, well, what is it?" Like those brutal black and white photos of bombed Iraq, I see the territory of her brain laid waste. Not so long ago, I had been haunted by air raid sirens on the nightly news in Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. I imagined the terror of waiting for bombs to strike, the noise, the concussion, the stench, the utter powerlessness. It was impossible for me to hear the sirens and not picture my mother and her parents trapped at a funeral in a hurricane of German bombs in 1941, or my father, a slave laborer for the Hungarian army, digging trenches under constant bombardment by the Soviets. How is there so much violence in her brain? It wasn't a bedtime story, nothing to make me sleep. It was a nightmare. My mother in one line, her mother in the other. The line going to the right, to gas, to death, to flames. Is it any wonder my mother was obsessed for years with asking if the stove was off? Leaving the apartment, driving off, she would say, "Alex, did I turn off the stove?" What is her vision? Flames ripping apart the life she has, the life she rescued from the past? I do it too now, though I'm older, perhaps as old as she was when I first noticed her concern. I ask Gersh, "Did you check the stove?" Sometimes he laughs, and sometimes I dread that passenger inside, that memory of her in fear. It's an electric stove. But still I can see myself driving back to find our home a black and ugly pile, destroyed. The quiet tree-lined streets scarred by smoke and stink. My secret terrors, like hearing noises late at night and imagining a murderer, a gun, or knives. I know from my parents' past, nothing is ever safe. Most of the time, it is knowledge I suppress. Those fatal lines. Was that the same place, the same camp, where an elegant woman opened a casket of jewels for the Nazi officer in charge to beg for her freedom, or at least for life? You can imagine what she got, my mother says, and I don't ask. Torn apart from home, from friends, from family, from life. I worry when Gersh is late or doesn't call when he said he would. I fear an accident or his death. Now, my brother says that he heard a different story about lines, that my mother told him something else, that her mother understood the meaning of the lines at once and shoved my mother across to life, to hope, despite her cries. Somebody beat the both of them, and that was all. My mother lived, knowing that she was saved by her own mother's hands. Who could live with such a scene? And yet she did. Maybe that's the scene that came back when my mother's brain caught fire when she attacked my brother and my father too, threw houseplants across the room and shouted out in German. I couldn't bear to ask for more, to ask what words returned to her, what pain. Knowing that they were German words was bad enough. I had rarely heard her speak that poisoned tongue. I wonder why she told my brother and me different versions of the truth. Was there some lesson we should learn? Did Sam know more because he's older, because he heard it closer to the past, to when it happened? As she grew older, was that crucial shove just too much to think about and repeat? And I wonder, who would I save, knowing that it meant my life? Thank you. We have time for questions and answers, not just questions. I came all the way from Okemos, so you've got to make it worthwhile. It's a very long and treacherous trip. Yes?
Was it easy for you the first time to publish the book?
My first book? Well, actually, it was easy in terms of getting it published,
yeah,
Yeah, actually, it was surprisingly easy, and easy in a bad way, because I won a prestigious prize at my graduate writing program. The judge was Martha Foley, a famous editor who knew Hemingway and Fitzgerald and that whole generation of writers. My writing workshop at the time hated the story and tore it apart in an hour and a half and you know, just tore me apart. And when I told this to this Martha Foley, she said, "Don't change a goddamn word." I sold it to Redbook like that. Redbook had 4.5 million readers. I got fan mail. I had tremendous response to the story. So that part was easy. The next part of my career was very hard because it took me 5 or 6 years to write another story that was good enough to be published. See, I had written this story in 24 hours. So I thought, well, I could churn out at least one of these a month, you know, and make quite a lot of money. That's how you think in New York. You think in those terms. And it just didn't happen. I hit a high with that story that I wasn't able to come back to for quite a long time. And part of it was that I really needed to leave New York and to find a new home. And once I got to Michigan, everything changed for the better. I had much more perspective on my past and on writing, and I started asking good questions as opposed to where am I going to publish next, who's my audience? And the first thing I started doing was sending my stories about children of survivors to Jewish magazines and newspapers. It sounds kind of simple, but it hadn't occurred to me. Because when you publish in Red Book and make a lot of money, then you think you should publish in The Atlantic and The New Yorker and every other prestigious national magazine of whatever kind. So the first part was easy. The second part was hard and really crushing. Sometimes I get half a dozen rejections in one day.
Well, what about getting launched insofar as novels are concerned? What publishers? How about that story?
It took me a long time to get my find a publisher for my first book of short stories. I tried lots of them. And that was back when there were lots of different publishers. And probably when I started out, there may have been dozens, over 30 or 40 individual publishers. Now everybody's sort of conglomerated. That was a little easier. I started then, no, I didn't, but I am publishing now mostly with small presses and a lot happier because they treat you much better and they care more about writing and they're more interested in building a career than the large houses are. The large houses are kind of like record companies now. If you're a new group, your first album has to go platinum, right? That shows my age. Your first CD has to go platinum. If it doesn't, then they drop you. They don't want you. Publishers are kind of like that too, and they want the first book to sell 50 to 100,000 copies, whatever it is, and that just is very hard to do. Yeah, the large publishers. The small publishers are looking at the long haul, you know, and kind of less hysterical about publishing is a better way of putting it, and smarter. Other questions? Well, oh, someone back there, yeah. No, in the shawl. Yes, you in the shawl. Yes?
Well, I have a practical question. You just said that it took a while before you were able to
What did I do to keep sane, or?
To survive.
Well, at that point. Absolutely. Well, right, you don't get tenure.
Even if you have a lot to say and you feel that you are very talented and you have a lot to contribute to the world, that's not always how it's perceived at the whatever level of publisher.
Right.
And so what do you do to eat and pay your
bills? You have to have a job. I was luckily at the time, I was a graduate student, so I was scraping along on not very much and was able to do it. And then I started teaching and here at State, and so I was making enough money to keep myself going. But I think the money is important, but I think also the self-esteem and the courage to keep going despite the rejection is really the hardest thing. And when I teach writing workshops and talk to young would-be writers, I say you have to be prepared for a lot of long-term disappointment, and because no matter what kind of writing you do, it's very hard to get in. It's very hard to break in. It doesn't matter what genre it is.
Do you think that you recommend generally that a prospective writer approach magazine publications before the book?
It depends on what it is. Usually publishers won't be interested in some. Every story in my first book of short stories had been published somewhere else. So what that tells a publisher is that then another editor has approved it. And that's what they're looking for. But, you know, sometimes people get contracts out of self-published books. I mean, there's really no rhyme or reason to the publishing world. That's the sad conclusion I reached very early on, that nothing really added up. You know, you think A plus B equals C, but it never did. Things never made sense. And things that you would expect to happen. I had a friend who won this big prize, and he was convinced that it was the beginning of, you know, one ecstasy after another, and it didn't happen. And I told him my experience with my prize. You know, I won this prize, it was published in Red Book, and then I had a 5-year period of absolutely nothing. And I think I've talked to more and more writers. That's more common than people realize. I've talked to writers who really have. It's not that their writing wasn't good necessarily. Maybe the timing was wrong. That's the other thing. Timing is important. And every book has its own karma. If a book comes out at the right moment and the right person reads it and the right person is going to push it, then it'll happen. And that's pretty hard to accept, because you think if you work hard, then you have to see some results from it. But, you know.
Are book agents on the way out?
I think they're not as popular as they used to be, because there's so much competition to get to them. And I think a lot of people are going unagented. I don't have an agent now, and for the first time in my career, I'm mentally healthy, I think, in terms of that. Because I had, I'll give you the short version. I actually did a talk on my 5 crazy agents. My first one was never responded to anything, never sent me publisher's letters, because she was sleeping with Saul Bellow at the time. He was her client, so she didn't have time for anyone but Saul Bellow. Not that I wanted to sleep with her, but, you know, she just didn't care about anyone else. My second agent left the business and kept sending a mystery of mine to people who didn't like mysteries. By the time I caught on, she quit the business, so I was without her. My next agent was considered by many publishers the slowest agent in New York. I only found this out after we signed with him. So slow that sometimes they'd wonder if he were dead, because they didn't hear from him for so long. And I should have known, because he told me that he was taking efficiency workshops, and that was a bad sign. My next agent was very nice, but never accomplished anything besides signing contracts, negotiating contracts, which I learned to do. And my fifth agent pursued me when she was in prepartum hysteria. I think she was pregnant, and she was really pursuing me very hard. And then she went kind of crazy and went off on a friend of mine who had signed with her and started spreading rumors. And my friend said, it was the hormones, it's not you. And she kept something in mind for 3 months that I had overnighted to her. So I don't know why, what that was about. So once five bad experiences, even I learned something. I mean, so I don't have an agent now. And I tell people to try other paths, because an agent it's very hard to get an agent. Even a good one, or a bad one, it's very hard to get them. There's too much competition. Any other questions about writing, or, yeah?
I just finished reading Winter Eyes.
Don't reveal the ending. Okay. Don't reveal the ending.
No.
Okay. Okay.
But I'm interested in the character of Stefan Voigt.
Mm-hmm.
And in your development of him, and you reveal so much of his thinking, and yet so little of his thinking about some of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, sexuality.
Right.
So I don't have anything more about it. Maybe this is not an appropriate question, but I was interested in the whole notion of the secrets in the house.
Right, because it's subtitled a novel about secrets, right.
Whether that sort of led you to decide what it is that you chose to have him reveal of himself.
Right, what to foreground and what to keep in the background. Yeah, he's got insight about certain things, but he doesn't have insight about other things, and that's part of what made him interesting to me as a character and how he develops over the course of the book. If you haven't read my mysteries, he is a character in my mystery series, grown up and a lot less hidebound by what has happened to him. So, and secrets, I mean, have always fascinated me, secrets and silence. When I was in college, I read Virginia Woolf's first novel, The Voyage Out, and someone asks a character in the book, oh, you're a writer, what kind of books do you want to write? And the man says, I want to write books about the things that people don't say. And that was like a bell going off in my head. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. So, and that's what I have done through pretty much consistently through my career is write books about the things people don't say one way or another. Sure, absolutely.
Part of what you
I'm not like George Bush. I allow follow-up questions.
And you can actually speak. Yeah. Well, apparently. No. You said before that in writing a Jewish life,
right.
And the book is about sexuality, and yet that is a silent aspect of the book.
I think it's not so silent.
In
Winter Eyes. Oh, right, yeah.
In Winter Eyes, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So I was interested in that decision. So much part of what you write, and yet it was very absent, other than the actual doing of it, but the whole notion of sexuality there.
Right. Well, the point of view is really limited to him, and how much you have to ask the question, how much does any character, any person know about themselves at any given time, and how well can he or she articulate what's going on inside of him? And he can see very clearly what's outside of him because his family, this isn't giving anything away, Winter Eyes is a story about a family of survivors that comes to America and decides to absolutely erase their entire past. And in America, they pretend that they're Polish Catholics. They're Polish and they have a Polish name, so they pretend to be Catholics, which they don't do a very good job of. And as anyone who's grown up in a family with secrets knows, the secret starts to burble out. And the son knows that there's something wrong. And eventually, he discovers it. But of course, he has his own secrets. So yeah, he was a challenge for me and an interesting character to work with. And if he knew too much, then he would be... He'd be, a child savant almost. There has to be things that he has to come to an awareness of. And originally, I had planned a kind of trilogy of books about him, but I'm too restless, and to stay with him at that point through two more books, I couldn't do. So he's a secondary character in my mystery series, and a lot happier than he was as a kid. And so am I. I think probably, I hope everyone in this room is a lot happier than they were as kids. Other questions? Yeah?
You mentioned that you were traveling to Germany.
Yes.
Reading your books.
Yep.
Do you, actually, two questions. How do you pick the topics or chapters of your books? And who's the audience?
Boy, I was there last fall. I had a very diffuse audience. I spoke at... the Katholische Akademie, Catholic University. I spoke to high school teachers of English. I had, citizens of all ages. I spoke to younger, sort of gymnasium, high school age students. It was pretty broad. I spoke at the Jewish Museum in Vienna. I chose something, whatever I chose from my book was something that I felt I could really deliver dramatically. because the reading is a performance. So that was one thing. And something that I thought was dramatic, because a couple of times, what happened in Germany is I would read something in English, then they would read something in German, and then I would come back in English, like to finish the section. Because the audiences, especially in Eastern Germany, the audiences didn't, you couldn't count on them knowing German, English. And so I picked things that were dramatic, even though my German readers would often try and dissuade me and say, don't read that, I don't think it's exciting enough. And I'd say, well, just wait a minute. And it all turned out well. So I read what I felt comfortable with, and after a while, I basically read the same thing so that I could really present it less as a reading and more as a performance. The response was good everywhere I went. I mean, especially in a few places, the high school teachers of English were just kind of blown away. And that felt really good. And every now and then, I don't think I got any, except my first night, I got somebody who kept asking me to explain the entire plot of the book, and people kind of suppressed her. But pretty much everyone else in Germany was really wonderful. And as someone said to me, well, of course they were wonderful. You're a child of Holocaust survivors. What are they going to be to you? I mean, you know, they're going to be nasty and sort of confirm any fears you might have had about going. But, you know, honestly, I found people very open and interested in talking about the Nazi regime and how survivors felt and survivors' children. It was pretty educational for me to go to Germany. And I'm really eager to go back. And I also learned some German for there, so to do some things in German, do my introduction in German. And so it was a great experience. I really want to go back. I never thought I'd say that. I want to go to Germany. And that's one thing they asked, would you come back? And I said, send me a ticket. Of course I'll come back. Yes, in the back.
I learned from your speech that you have traveled to a lot of places. And do this Germany
count for you? Oh, absolutely. I think any place I go, I'm always alert to the people and the setting. I often find that something that I'm working on in one city or at home will be clearer to me when I'm in another city. So, for instance, you know, it's not Camden, New Jersey. It's not a very exotic town, but I taught a writer's workshop at Rutgers, and I'm doing a keynote address at a literacy banquet in Michigan. And being in New Jersey somehow made it all very clear what I had to say and how. So simply distance makes things clearer. I also get ideas when I'm in other countries, and I have an idea for a book about Germany by going to Germany. I've traveled in Western Europe a lot, and I'm thinking about things set in London and Brussels and Paris. So it's more in the sense, it's two things. It's a sense of material, potential material, and also it's kind of the being shaken up, shaken out of your own language. I mean, I speak French well when I'm relaxed, and I've been in France for a few days. All my tenses come back, the imperfect and the subjunctive. And that's it's always very liberating for me in a way to speak another language. It was liberating to speak German in Germany, to step out of my own language and to sort of feel like a very different person. So it does mean a lot. And also, I mean, when you become an actor in another language, I mean, because you're partly to some extent watching yourself. So I know in France I feel more relaxed. In Germany, how did I feel? I can't say strict or orderly or something, but I felt different. And that's something that I want to explore. Like, what did it mean to be feeling different in Germany, and what was the nature of that feeling exactly? Because so much was going on, I couldn't even keep good notes because it was just, I was overwhelmed by stimuli. So hopefully this next tour will be a little calmer. Actually, I was through a series of misadventures. I walked into the hotel next to the Catholic University in Berlin, where I was scheduled to speak at 7. I walked in at 7:10. I was that late on every leg of my flight, and just sort of washed my face and walked next door and just started my shtick, you know. And it was pretty amazing. I was just happy to be able to speak any language at all, let alone German and English. And other questions? I think we have time for a few more. Yes?
Sorry,
sure.
Have you ever experienced frustration during the writing? For example, maybe one day you finish a book and you can write several chapters, but you can't
I don't experience frustration in writing. And people talk a lot about writer's block and then being so blocked they can't sign a check or, you know, put write a post-it note. I have always been very happy writing. I know people like Andy Dillard say writing is agony and torment and they can't stand it. And I think, yeah, well, you're a millionaire. You can afford to say that, I guess. I don't know. I love writing. And for me, if I get to a place and it's not working, then I just shift to something else. It's been helpful for me to write in different genres. And it's also helpful for over a decade, I reviewed for various publications. So if I couldn't work in my book, I would, you know, do a review. Or I'd go to the gym. You know, that's why I tell my writing students, go to the gym, take a walk, go see a movie. Don't get stuck in being stuck. Just get yourself out of it and direct your attention to something else. So I really don't get frustrated. I just, you know, if I'm not writing, I'm not writing. If, for me, the opposite is actually true. I'm always writing if I'm really deep in something. So this morning, I had to get off the treadmill at the Mac and run and find a piece of paper somewhere and a pen because a book that I'm working on was unreeling in my head. And I thought, I just can't. If I stay on the treadmill another 5 minutes, I'll forget what it is that I want to say. That's my problem, is that I have too much going on, and sometimes it's hard to turn it off. You had another question, yeah.
You write about memory, and you just mentioned Germany, and the memory happens to be about Germany in three ways. I don't know whether you have any comments about three things. One is the Jewish Museum in Berlin, which is another form of memory.
Right.
The new memorial, and then another German author who's written quite a bit about German memory.
Oh, yeah, suddenly Günter Grass just suddenly remembered that he was in the SS, you know, just happened to forget or didn't want to remember. Boy, that's a lot of questions. I did not. Or, well, if you haven't seen the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, it's absolutely stunning. Because it's a bunch of, is it granite? It's a bunch of hundreds of granite pillars. And what's amazing about it is that they're at all different heights, and some lean. And so you can be walking across, and your path will go up and down, and people will appear and disappear in different vistas. And it's a really amazing objective correlative for being lost and for having things taken away from you, because when you get all the way to the center, it's a little creepy, and I think appropriately so. And you're lower than the street level. You could Google it and find pictures of it online. It's really quite a stunning way of memorializing the Holocaust. You know, my publisher took me there, and I, you know, again, I'm the child of Holocaust survivors. Well, I approve of it, you know. And if I don't approve of it, what? They'll tear it down. I mean, it's. And I couldn't get over it. I just kept walking around and inside and looking at it and taking pictures and thinking, this is so big, you could never see or experience all of it, which is brilliant because it's an analogy to the Holocaust. You can never see and experience all of it because historians keep finding new pieces of the Holocaust every year. More and more information comes out, things that we didn't know. So I think it's a stunning monument. Next time I want to go to the museum. I was in Berlin and I did certain things, but I also had to have meetings with my publisher, so my time was a little too tight. And then also when you're on tour, you just want to crawl under the bed in the hotel and just hide for a while. You know, you're just so tired. So one more question. Anyone? Peter? Do you? No? Okay, thank you for coming.